Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10x points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions.
Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Holla talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today, we're answering your listener questions.
Right, buddy. This is our listener questions episode. And for new listeners here who may have discovered us recently, the way it works is every other Monday, we take listener questions. We answer five of those. And on the alternating Mondays, we like to have bring somebody else here on the show. We have interviews. And
with experts who...
with the money pros.
Dive deep.
Actually, that's what we used to call those episodes. We wouldn't even interview with them. We would just... it was kind of like a combination of listener questions with an interview. But we found that there was a better way of going about that. And that's actually having a conversation with our money expert.
Yeah. So we've had some really good... I loved our episode with Katie Milkman. Our next interview episode actually is going to be all about budgeting with our friend Jesse Meacham, who runs YNABS. That's going to be really fun.
You can look forward to that one.
A week from today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You see, we're just trying to get folks clued in a little bit as to our format and
here's
how it works
the
here.
HTM calendar works, right?
But we've got five great listener questions to get to today. A listener is asking about basically like how to make withdrawals when you have an online bank. Another listener, he's wondering if he should switch back to target date funds because he found out that by going with an S&P 500 fund, that is costing him more money.
Surprising.
That's very rare.
We'll reveal why in a minute.
Exactly, yeah. And then we've got some late-breaking tax news, some tax reporting news that will likely have an impact on a lot of folks, in particular folks who use some of the different platforms out there like Venmo or Cash App.
Yeah. All right, we'll get to all those listener questions in 1 second. But first, Matt, I want to do a frugal or cheap for you here. And
always love those.
It's been a minute, I think, since we've done one. But we have a potato peeler, carrot peeler, just one of the hand peelers, right? And it's not terribly expensive. You can probably get them on Amazon for $7 or $8.
Mm-hmm.
But ours like literally snapped in half. And I don't know how long we've had it. I truly don't know how long we've had it. I don't know how long they're supposed to last or if they're supposed to snap in half for a certain duration.
Just the handle broke off?
The handle separated from the peeler portion.
Okay,
right?
While you were going to town on, I'm going to guess, a potato.
Yes, a potato.
Oh, really?
Yes. So
I can see you doing that.
Potatoes and carrots are my favorite two things to peel. But so this broke in half and I was like, okay, this is actually a decent brand. I truly don't know how long we've had this. We might have had it for 10 years or something like that. And so I was like, but I wonder if they saw a picture of this, if they would just want to send me a new one. Mm-hmm. Just to, because who knows if, again, how long these things are supposed to last. And so I reached out on Twitter to this company and I said, hey, here's a look at my peeler. I was just wondering if this is normal or if you guys would be interested or willing to send me a replacement. And they were super cool about it. And they were like, hey, no problem. Yeah, we'll send you a new peeler because
nice.
They ain't supposed to break in half like this. And it's, we stand by our stuff kind of thing, yeah. Right? And my wife,
they are
she
one
said
of those...
I was being cheap, though, for asking. She was like, dude, it's a peeler. Buy a new one. Stop this. Stop this insanity. So, all right, I want to know from your perspective.
Well,
am I frugal or cheap?
Whether you're being frugal or cheap. So the question is, how did you go about getting their attention? Was this a public tweet?
No.
Was it
a DM? And I just said, hey, guys, here's a picture of the peeler.
See,
what do you think?
I think that's totally fine because it's not like you're dragging their name through the mud, just being like, look at this piece of crap vegetable peeler that just broke in half on me, where you're
no, I refuse
disparaging
to take
that
text.
Them.
No,
yeah,
I'm not gonna do
okay. Because if you would have said that, I would have said, dude, that's kind of cheap.
That's being a jerk, really.
Reaching out to them via the DMs, man, that is I think one of the best ways of reaching out to a company without having to pick up the phone and actually make a call.
Okay.
And in this case, especially too, since you had a picture, dude, this is a multimedia request where you're able to show them, obviously, their product and how it didn't work out for you, how it failed. So I think...
Will you talk to Emily for me?
This is totally frugal.
Clear my name?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
Because that's the... I would... Honestly, I would reach out more to companies if it wasn't such a hassle and a platform like Twitter.
Twitter makes it easy.
Can make it so stinking easy. That might be... I think maybe the last time I actually used Twitter was to reach out to a company.
Well, we've talked about that for a long time, that Twitter can help resolve customer service issues faster than a phone call can, right? That sometimes the most easy way to get a company's attention is through social media, and in particular Twitter. That just seems to be where they have their Comcast Cares or Delta Help or whatever it is.
On high alert right
there.
Yeah. Well, because they know that it wouldn't be too difficult to copy that message and instead of making it a DM, making that a public tweet.
Yes. Yeah. So I think they're more inclined to help people that way. And this company, I'll name them, OXO. They were kind enough to replace my peeler. So thank you.
You say OXO or?
No,
I always say OXO.
Okay.
Like, what is it? Kiss, hug, kiss.
All right, maybe that's
what
it.
I always thought, ever since I always thought.
Well, they sent me a new peeler. I got to keep $8 in my pocket.
Nice, dude.
Yeah.
Love it.
All right, well, let's mention the beer we're having on this episode. This one is called Wit. It's by St. Bernardus and just a classic brewery out of Belgium. We will give our thoughts on this beer at the end of the episode. But, Matt, let's get to the topic at hand. We're answering listener questions. And for listeners out there who want us to answer their question on a future Ask HTM episode, just go to howtomoney.com/ask. There are simple instructions there for you to submit your own question, and hopefully we'll be able to take it soon. But this first question is about doing business with the online banks.
Hi, guys. This is Dave from Minnesota. Love your podcast. I have a question about online banking. After listening to you guys talk about online banking and the huge difference in savings interest, I asked my wife when the last time was that she needed to go to the bank, and neither of us had in quite a while, except for getting larger amounts of cash out when we need to buy things from Facebook Marketplace, Craigslist, or a used car. So I decided I was tired of getting next to nothing for my savings interest and started looking for an online bank to start with. Then I started seeing that some don't accept cash deposits, and it got me thinking about how I would get cash out for more than what the ATM would allow. After doing some searching, I saw some stuff that said you could use something called debit card cash advances, and some said that worked, some said it didn't work. But anyway, I'm wondering how you guys handle the larger cash withdrawal issue. Keep up the good work.
All right, Dave, thank you so much for your question, and I like where your head's at. You're thinking through all of the implications here before you take that leap.
You're looking before you leap.
Look before you leap.
As my mom always told me to do, which I rarely paid attention to.
That's right.
Sorry,
but let's talk through this cash conundrum of banking online, because, although like credit card usage, online payment methods, they have certainly proliferated over the years, resulting in fewer cash transactions. This is certainly probably the biggest detractor from going fully online with your banking needs. And even if it is a rare, if it's just an occasional occurrence, it's worth thinking through before you 100% stop doing business with a bank that does have those brick and mortar locations where you can go in, make that deposit, actually withdraw large amounts of cash and also get that piece of bubble gum or sucker.
we often talk about online banks. They're our favorite. Like, when you boil it down, if you were to say, hey, I just want to have one banking relationship, where should I go? Online banks are what we recommend because they have that best overall combination. But you're right, Matt, there's the cash question which comes up. So what's the solution to that? Well, ATM withdrawals, like Dave said, I mean, can help with those medium-sized purchases, like buying something off Craigslist or Facebook Marketplace. I mean, the best online banks offer access to a nationwide network of ATMs where you can get money out without paying any fees, which I think is great. That was one of the things.
Or they say that they'll reimburse a certain, you know, $20 worth of ATM fees every month or $12.
Which changed the game for online banks, because for minute it was like, cool, there's just, that was a real problem. And then...
Do you remember instead of withdrawing cash from the ATM, just going to like the counter and buying a pack of gum and doing the cash back?
To get the cash back,
It's like, I need $20 in order to go fill up the car or hang out with my friends.
But then, you know, Capital One got the Allpoint relationship, and it was you could get ATMs all over the place even if you had an online bank, which helped a great deal and really made it possible for a lot more people to transition over to online banks. But that being said, there's a daily limit typically of $500 or so. Some will let you take out $1,000 in a day. That's not going to be enough, though, to buy like a used car, right? Unless you're just a massively frugal person looking to buy a very, very inexpensive beat-down old ride. But not to mention the inconvenience of having to make multiple trips to an ATM over the course of a week or two to get all that cash on hand in order to make that purchase. So depending on how far away the ATM is, this is beginning to look less frugal and more cheap. So yeah, maybe we should talk a little more about what it looks like if you handle cash on the reg and you still want to do business with an online bank.
Sure, which I can't remember the last time I needed, personally, large amounts of cash on hand. But Dave, for you, I think another option is just to maintain a bank account or a bank relationship with a local brick-and-mortar bank, and then you can just transfer larger sums for a cash withdrawal whenever it is that you need access to a bunch of cash. And another positive benefit here is that way you can meet the seller at that institution, at that bank, for increased safety, right? That way you're not carrying around a wad of cash. That feels kind of, you feel a little vulnerable when you've got thousands of dollars in your pocket.
I mean, I know some people still, like, they rubber band tons of cash and they keep them in their pocket. That has always seemed odd to me. And they peel off, you know, money to hand to their waiter or whatever they're at.
Yeah, it's not the 1970s anymore. But in this example, though, you haven't gone 100% online, but you are keeping the vast majority of your money with an online savings or checking account. You're earning the highest rate of interest there, but then you're able to use that local brick and mortar whenever it is that you need it. The downside here, though, is that the most prominent local banks, they're often going to be, you know, typically one of the bigger banks who we're not big fans of, and because they charge a monthly fee for their checking accounts, unless you either have a recurring deposit or a certain specific number of transactions every single month. That's a bummer. Yeah. That's it's a headache where, you know, were you to have to try to maintain that. That is the reason that I finally closed down my relationship with a local big bank years ago now, was because they were I needed to have a total of $2,000 in those accounts. I needed to have something like $500 in the checking and $1,500 in the savings account in order for those accounts to technically be free. I didn't like that. It wasn't that much money, but from a principal standpoint, this is a company that had misbehaved, and I was done with them. I was ready to kick them to the curb.
No, I get that. Well, and you and I, if folks have been listening for any period of time, they know that we have an aversion to fees, and we want people to eliminate and eradicate fees from their life in any way that they can. And bank fees are one of those like low-hanging fruits where it's like, just go somewhere else, because there's a whole lot of banks that don't charge those crappy fees, that aren't trying to play that game with you. And there are other ways for those banks to make money. So yeah, prioritize doing business with a bank that doesn't charge any fees. And if you do have one of those local banks that isn't going to make you jump through a bunch of hoops to eliminate fees, then yeah, that might be a good backup to your online banking relationship. Another option would be to do business with the local credit union. That's a great way to avoid the headache or monthly fee that might get from a big bank instead. And you know, Matt, we talked about this too. We think that everybody or most people should have a relationship with a local credit union anyway, because if you happen to be in the position where you'll need to take out a loan, oftentimes a credit union can offer you the best rate.
Yeah. And hopefully not for something like a car loan, because that's not something we want to see you taking a loan out for. But if you want to have like a backstop to your emergency fund, where maybe you're going to take out a HELOC. Yeah. That's something that I did a number of years ago.
Or you're buying a house. You want to get a mortgage quote from a credit union in addition to online banks and you know, and other mortgage brokers.
Yeah. And that's, I've done both of those things, gotten mortgages and HELOCs with local credit unions, because they were the ones who offered the best rate by far.
Yep. And on the front, they can act like that local bank account and that local place to do the transaction, but without those monthly fees typically. So like, for instance, one of our local credit unions here in Atlanta requires just a $5 deposit and you get to join the club. You get to be the credit union member, right?
Like, welcome to the party.
And so then that combo of online bank and credit union could be even better than the combo of online bank and big brick and mortar bank. Mm-hmm. The biggest downside, though, of your local credit union is the online experience isn't all that great. The user interface on many of their websites could stand to be improved.
Totally.
But still, I think you can deal with that for the times you do need to use that account to transfer money from your online bank in over into your credit union. Or if you do get a bunch of cash and you're like, okay, I don't want this lying around in my house, you can just take that into your credit union deposit and then move the funds back over to your online bank account if that's what you prefer.
Totally, yeah. They also may not have an app for you to use. I mean, they're like, what app? What are you talking about? So with one
still
of the
built on MS-DOS or something.
Yeah, like, yeah. You have to like punch in the codes, type in that exe to execute to run. But with one local credit union that I had a mortgage with, one of the things I realized that I think they did just to cut corners from like a legal standpoint, but maybe just to save money, is that they didn't issue regular monthly statements for the mortgage that I had with them. And of course, that got paid online, so you're probably thinking, well, it's not that, who cares, right? Well, anytime I needed to apply for another mortgage for a separate property, they always want to see the most recent two statements,
yeah,
at least, right? And like the most recent statement would be from 8 months ago. And so I would always have to go to the lender and say, I'm sorry, I'm with this credit union. They don't issue regular monthly statements. It's not that they're not being delivered to me. They don't create them. Yeah. Like they only do them like once every 6 months. And so I'd always have to do like a series of screenshots.
Yeah.
I'm of like my payment history, yeah, and then another screenshot of my loan balance and be like, this is all I got.
I remember,
is that okay?
To do the same thing.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, that's one of those janky things that sometimes local credit unions,
it felt
if they've got two
janky
or three branches and they're super small, they just don't have the infrastructure to deliver the services that a lot of the other banks and that your
that
online bank
to
is going to be able to give you. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And Dave was also wondering about depositing cash. And that's another side of the coin here to address. Some banks actually have workarounds. So Capital One 360, they actually take cash deposits at CVS pharmacies, which is really cool. They'll accept up to $999 a day.
Oh.
Don't you dare give them $1,000, Joel.
Like, I'm sorry, sir. I'm going to have to give this dollar back to you.
Exactly. I got 10 $100 bills here, and it's like, here you go. But you can also deposit cash at their ATMs. But again, Joel, sort of like you said, I mean, I think it makes sense to keep some cash on hand for some of those random times that you need cash for spending, right? And so you might receive some cash after maybe making a sale. Well, keep that cash on hand.
Or
don't worry about depositing it.
Really generous to you over the holidays. And you're like, your Christmas present is $500.
Nice,
like,
fat tip.
Yeah.
Well, keep that on hand the next time you need to make a purchase on Facebook Marketplace. I mean, we're not talking about a large amount of interest here. And that's also, it's not the kind of money were you to keep it in a safe,
yeah,
secure place in your home. At least for me, that's not necessarily going to make me nervous about keeping that kind of money,
sure,
in my house. But if that is you, if you don't like having that cash hanging around, just maybe spend it on groceries that month, and then just make a note of it in your budget. Deduct that from the, you know, I guess it depends on what app you use. In my mind, I'm picturing my Excel sheet, but I would say if I had $500 that I was going to put towards groceries, just subtract $500 from the monthly amount and just reset it for the following month. But Dave, you know, if this is something that feels like a major issue for you, just make sure that you're able to prioritize a bank, doing business with a bank, one of the online banks that makes it easier to withdraw and deposit cash. You know, because I think the cash dilemma of going online with your banking, it kind of seems like a small one that should rarely be an issue. I feel like it's one that weighs more on our minds, like in the what if scenario, opposed to something that we are actually facing regularly.
Almost like range anxiety for electric vehicles. People are like, oh no, it's only got 240 miles of range. How am I going to make it through a day? But most people who finally actually start driving an EV, they realize that worry was overblown. And granted,
yep,
how often do you take a road trip? Like, it's not going to be great for the road trip that's, you know, 600 miles in distance, you're going to have to recharge a couple of times. But I think it's very similar to that, where
there's a very simple, easy workaround.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to stress you out.
And people build it up in their minds to be worse than it's actually going to be. And so, yeah, I think the plus sides of having a relationship with an online bank far outweigh the downsides of that move. And I think, mm-hmm, you should make an online bank in all likelihood your main bank. And then, yeah, hopefully we gave you some good ideas, some good suggestions, so that you can still move cash around when need be. But Dave, best of luck to you on that front. All right, Matt, we've got more listener questions to get to, including a kind of nerdy question about rental property investing. We're actually going to get to that one next, right after this. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach every single summer. We've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. And now a word from the show's sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry, Betterment is here to help.
Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal. Rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again.
Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
We are back from the break, and Joel, we will eventually get to that target date funds question. We'll talk about that here in a second, but like you alluded to before the break, let's hear that question from a listener who has a newly acquired investment property.
Hi, guys. Longtime listener. Love the podcast and appreciate you guys always answering listener questions. I have a question as a new renter. We just rented our first house, and we're doing it just directly us to the renter. I was curious if you guys did yours under a business as an LLC, or do you maintain your relationship with your renters just through person-to-person interaction as well? Also love beer, place I'd recommend if you ever get a chance and you're in Charlotte, Armored Cow Brewery. And my favorite beer there is the Bang Bang Hazy IPA. Thanks in advance.
All right, Corey, love that question, and I've not heard of the brewery you just mentioned before.
Did he say Armored Cow?
I think so.
Okay.
Which,
nice.
I mean, there's all
like
sorts
an armored
of,
car, but an armored cow.
All sorts of funky names for breweries these days. We're all about it. I feel like there's even more funky names for the actual beers that they make. But yeah, we're always up for a new beer, new brewery. Next time we're in Charlotte, we'll hit it up.
And hopefully we can get a taste of some of that stuff soon.
For sure. And Corey, you're a new landlord, so we're pumped for you on that front. This question about whether or not to form an LLC, it's a very, very good one. And for anybody who is considering investing in real estate, this is an answer you're going to want to listen to, because I'm sure this is going to cross your mind at some point. And you might be actually surprised to hear that neither Matt or I have actually formed an LLC for any of our rental properties. That doesn't mean that it's not the best way forward in some cases. So let's talk about why you might want to go that route. And so the legal designation that an LLC can provide would be able to help insulate your personal assets from a potential tenant lawsuit, right? In that unfortunate event that something happened. It's like this protective bubble of sorts. And if you go this route, you're going to want to have one for each and every property, not just one LLC for all your properties if you own, like, let's say five or six, because then someone sues the LLC, and then all of those properties are lumped under one bubble, you want to create a separate bubble for each and every one. And so LLCs cost money. It's important to mention that. Each LLC you have is going to cost you money to create, and then somewhere between $100 and $800 a year, I think, Matt, in California, $800 is the annual amount you have to pay if you have an LLC.
Everything costs more in California.
It does. So it's just important to note that, like,
instead, you might want to look into incorporating in Delaware, right. The most popular state to form a business.
Yeah, but that's just one thing worth mentioning, is that the cost factor associated with LLCs. But on the other side, it can provide legal protection, a massive amount of legal protection, just curbing the ability of a lawsuit to impact all of your personal finances. It's really just allowing someone to come after, in the case of a lawsuit, that one property that is siloed away as an LLC.
That's right. Yeah. An LLC quite literally limits the liability to just that specific corporation. And actually, I think the precedent for this being decided was, I think the Supreme Court decided, this is like decades ago, but it was something like a taxi cab company owner. He actually incorporated each one of his taxi cabs as their own corporations. Like,
that's,
they each have their LLC.
So if one driver gets in a wreck,
exactly,
it doesn't bring down the whole company.
Exactly. And so, and they, the court decided, nope. And so I guess the owner may have lost that singular cab when, I don't know, that driver struck a pedestrian or something like that. But at least the owner was able to maintain the rest of his, the company, the rest of his taxi cabs. But yes, it does cost you money to create and maintain these LLCs. That being said, it's not a deal breaker, right? Even though the money to create these things, like, they do add up. There's folks who definitely go this route for that protection. But, the, you know, I think the reason we've never really opted to go the LLC route before is just because of what's known as the due on sale clause. When we talk to some lawyer friends, they've advised us against going this route because there's this chance, even though it's kind of a small chance, but there's a chance that your lender could basically tell you that you've got a month. You've got, I think, exactly 30 days to pay off your mortgage if you transfer ownership of that property from yourself to a separate company. And so is that something, yeah, that happens very often? Not really. Not from everything that we've heard of from other real estate investors, of, you know, from what we've read. And the guidelines were actually rewritten by Fannie Mae back in 2017 to make it far less likely that this could even happen. But at least at the time when we were kind of first starting out, it freaked us out enough that we opted to go a different route. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should consider, though, right? Especially as our net worth, our personal wealth has grown over the years, because an LLC, it can be a really helpful wealth protection mechanism should adverse circumstances come along.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it is something that I think that due on sale clause, we got freaked out a little bit, but I think it's not... It's not much of an issue. And so I think an LLC should be on your radar, and it might make the most sense for you depending on your specific situation. But there's also another route that real estate investors can and should consider, and that's an umbrella policy with your insurance company, because those can provide a ton of coverage and they're pretty inexpensive too. So basically, you want to have the landlord policy in place like you do on any rental property that you own.
Also known as a dwelling fire policy, because it covers the actual property, not the contents of the property. So not the possessions of whoever's renting the property.
And that's because the tenant who's in there has renter's insurance.
Or they should.
Mm-hmm. And that covers their possessions. But if you add, in addition to that landlord policy, that's what I'm going to call it, then you can add an umbrella policy above and beyond it, giving yourself coverage in... Like, basically, it's doled out in millions. So you could choose just a flat out $1 million umbrella policy.
Just a cool $1 million.
Yeah. Or you could bump it up to $2 million or $3 million, depending on kind of the amount of assets you're looking to have insured. And the great thing about these policies is that they provide just a large monetary amount of coverage for a meager amount of money. So that means, like, it could be like $300, $400, $500 annually for $1 million policy.
It's really affordable.
Which could cover multiple rental units, right? And so, yeah, This second layer might provide all the coverage that a real estate investor needs, but it's also important to know the limitations of both of these options. Neither one is completely foolproof, and we're not lawyers, and so we're not going to go...
This is not legal financial advice.
Right, yes. So we're not going to go into that, but just know that those are kind of the two mechanisms that real estate investors would typically use to shield themselves from some legal liabilities if stuff were to go down that obviously you don't want to go down. And I think depending on your particular situation, either one could be a good choice.
Yeah, not only could that umbrella policy cover rental properties that you own, but it also covers you as an individual. Mm-hmm. And so let's say you have a partner, it could cover you and your partner. And not only when it comes to those investment properties, but also when it comes to coverage that goes above and beyond, say, your auto insurance. So your liability insurance that you have on your car. That's another sweet little feature that you get with umbrella insurance. But Joel, let's hear now from our next listener. He's got a question about this fun little refund that he was receiving from an investment that was within his 401k.
Hey, Matt and Joel. This is Kevin from Massachusetts. I recently changed my contributions from my work-provided target date fund to the low-cost Fidelity 500 index fund. With this new investment, it does look like I'm paying over triple in fees now. But apparently there was a revenue credit that was there when I was in the target date fund, which I didn't pay attention to, but now no longer applies to my current election. From what I found, revenue credit is an incentive for groups to invest in a certain fund, but not sure if that's correct. Should I leave it as it is, or is it worth switching back since fees do eventually add up? Thanks for all the help you guys provide, and of course, the beer recommendations.
All right, Kevin, this is a great question, and this is kind of a unique one, Matt. Like, this isn't something that most of our listeners are probably going to encounter at any point in their investing lives. It's just not widely applicable, but I just thought it was so interesting. I'm like, we need to talk about this.
This is a great way for us to talk about the revenue credit, baby.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the revenue credit, this is an interesting thing, and it is when a 401k provider refunds money to folks in that that particular fund because the expenses associated with running that fund were less than they projected. And bigger employers, states, and university systems, they're basically, how it works is they're able to negotiate for these revenue credits in return for bringing a lot of customers to that brokerage firm and to that particular fund. And so, individual investors, like Kevin here, are able to get a credit for investing in specific funds inside of that retirement plan. It's kind of interesting. Again, this isn't something associated with most plans, so most of our listeners are probably like, never heard of it, never experienced it, which I get. But Kevin, he's kind of incentivized, I guess, to invest in a particular fund because of this revenue credit that's associated with it.
Sure. It makes me think of, do you get any like no claim check rewards or whatever from your insurance company if you haven't made a claim that year? It kind of makes me think of that. Sort of like this like end of year, it's a nice little bonus where it's just like, hey, we appreciate you. And even though it's for a small amount, it generates these warm feelings inside of me. And it makes me want to stay with that company even if my independent insurance broker agent tells me to go somewhere else. I think I'm going to have some feelings of like, oh, but they send me money.
But they share the wealth. They share the savings back with me.
Exactly. So I feel like there's a similar effect, like a similar emotional effect going on here with some of these different brokerages. But this is neat. It's just not something that's super widespread. It's not super applicable to everyone out there. And so if you're thinking, well, where's my revenue credit? Well, there's a good chance that you probably aren't entitled to one. But for you, Kevin, it's cool that at least one fund in your portfolio is offering this revenue credit. But which fund should you be in? You're talking about whether you should stick with the index fund, the S&P 500 Fidelity Fund that you mentioned, or that target date fund. And so which one you choose will depend on a few things. You talk about the fact that the fees are something like 3 times more. That's certainly a big deal.
Yeah, right? Shocking on
like
its
that's
face.
300%, that's a massive difference. But here's the thing. Are we talking about like 0.02% versus 0.06%? Or are we, talking like a 0.1 versus 0.3 difference? Because at least a part of how we would make this decision would be based on just how big of a spread there is between the fees of the two funds. And not just based purely on the fact that they're 3x higher, right? Yeah. 3 times higher. I kind of crunched the numbers a little bit here. And I think a lot of folks might say, well, it doesn't matter. From a principal standpoint, I don't want to pay more than I have to. And I totally get that. Like, I never want to pay more than I need to for something as well. But just to put things in perspective a little bit, if we're talking about, say, maxing out, well, he's talking about 401k, but I run the numbers on an IRA. So $6,500 over the next 30 years, if you were to pay with one fund 0.06 and another one, you would be paying 0.02 in fees. You're only talking about a $5,000 difference in the final value of that portfolio after 30 years.
Yeah, that's pretty minimal.
That's pretty minimal. Three decades.
I mean, it's still a lot of money. Like if someone handed me $5,000 right now, I'd be pumped.
I'm not going to turn down $5,000.
But over 30 years, you're talking about it's minuscule from that perspective.
Exactly. So I don't know. I don't know if that's helpful for you or if you're like, no, I want that five, I want that $5,000.
Okay.
Because you're talking about, again, $5,000 that grows and is earned over a very long period of time.
Well, that's a really important point to make. Like how much of a difference, the spread between those numbers, between that 3X, you know, change or difference, that's going to make a big difference. But also, you know, we're typically talking about the opposite, right? We're typically talking about target date funds being more costly from a fee perspective, but Kevin's in the opposite boat here.
Yeah, that's why this is kind of so rare, because oftentimes folks are wanting to shy away from those target date funds because you're paying for some of that automation that's built into those target date funds.
Yeah, and I think there are a couple other things that Kevin's going to want to consider besides just the fee, right? Because if fees were the only thing that drove us, we might choose funds that weren't the best for us. Typically, index funds are the cheapest, but in this case, they're not. And so it's just interesting to note that fees are one helpful decision maker, but they shouldn't make the whole decision. Another part should come down to how hands-on or hands-off you want to be, right? Because at some point in your life, you're likely going to want to dial back your risk exposure. And target date funds, they kind of do that automatically for you over time. So that's probably the number one reason target date funds have become so freaking popular is because people are like, I don't want to think about this ever.
It's automatic.
I want to grow my wealth. I want to invest for my future, but I don't want to have to know anything or do any research or like open or turn on CNBC. Like, I don't want any of the above. And so people choose target date funds. And I think I'm glad they exist for that reason, because there are people who otherwise would not invest, but they do it because target date funds exist. And
exactly.
I think that's great. It's a good choice for, and I don't mean this in a pejorative way or in a bad way, but lazy investors. Like, it's a completely fine approach. And the thing is, though, too, that not all target date fund options are created equal. Kevin's has a lower expense ratio, but that's just not the case for most people. And typically when we talk about good target date funds, we're talking about the ones from low-cost companies like Vanguard, Fidelity, and Schwab.
That's right, man. Yeah, so how involved an investor might want to be when it comes to their investments is something they want to keep in mind, in addition to the fees that those funds may be levying upon the investor. But performance, that's a whole other factor as well, because it's important to mention that returns over the decades are likely going to be slightly higher in that index fund as well. Not necessarily by a ton, and that's, you know, target date funds, they have a higher bond exposure, and this actually means that they're likely to underperform the overall stock market over a longer timeline. But another major difference is that you'll own quite a bit more international stocks and bonds as well. Certainly you have some international exposure with the S&P 500, but we're talking about a good bit more with target date funds. And so when you look at the returns over the past 5 years, the S&P 500 has beaten funds like the Vanguard 2060 target date fund quite handily. And a huge part of the reason for that is the underperformance of international equities. And so I'm not trying to make any predictions here, right? Like, will that continue to be the case? It is hard to say. It's difficult to predict what is going to happen out there in the world, Joel.
Yeah. I mean, if you're able to, Matt, let me know, because I will follow you anywhere.
Jim Cramer and I, we are on a mission to make all the predictions.
There's actually like a Twitter account, I think, that's like telling people what to do, to do the opposite thing of what Cramer predicts.
It's short, yes. Cramer or whatever. Yeah, exactly. You know, a big part of your decision should come down to what sort of international exposure that you want to have moving forward as well. But Kevin, I think another part too is, like, if you're thinking about whether to move back, you know, if you want to switch back to the fund that you were holding, certainly you want to keep performance in mind, but just how easy it is to do as well. And you're talking about, you know, buying and selling these ETFs or funds within your 401k. That sounds really easy to do. It's not like you're having to open up an entirely new account.
And it's not creating a tax consequence, unlike doing that in a brokerage account.
Exactly, right? Which is why we're totally okay with you making these switches within a tax deferred account like this. But, you know, honestly, this has got me thinking back to, like, I gave the little example about the $5,000 over 30 years. Mm-hmm. And now I'm starting to, like, now I'm thinking to myself, well, if there's a change I could make right now and that would give me $5,000 more, even in 30 years, I think I would do that.
Yeah.
I think I would go ahead and make that switch. And so I think some of it comes down to you as an individual, how organized you can be. If you're someone who, like you were saying, with hands-off versus hands-on approach, Joel, if you're somebody who, and you don't want to think about this, you don't want to mess with it, maybe just keep the S&P 500, but then moving forward, continue to buy the target date fund.
Mm-hmm.
And when it comes to even more serious moves, like I'm thinking about adding money to a Roth IRA over on Robinhood, but that would mean keeping up with another account, but I'm also very organized. And I would feel completely okay with having another login, having another account to check on, because they got that that 1% match. Mm-hmm. And I think the returns are something, or there's something similar. It's not huge for them to be able to provide that 1% match. But if in 30 years, that means I can have an extra $5,000, why wouldn't I go ahead and be funneling that money over there?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think
kind of comes down to the individual and what they're willing to sign up for.
Yeah, exactly. So I think you need to think about the fees, but you need to think about more than just the fees. You need to think about your own propensity, right, to keep up with the investments that you're making. It sounds like Kevin's on the ball, so he might be willing to change his asset allocation as his risk tolerance changes, which makes me think that index funds might suit him better. But it's also important to think about potential return over the decades. And so fees are important, but potential for higher returns is important to think about too. So we're funds of both approaches for different folks, right?
Yeah.
Different strokes.
Target
different
date
folks.
Funds are awesome.
Yep.
The S&P 500, that's my favorite. I love it.
Yeah. And the great thing is, part of the reason we like both is because neither of them are terribly complicated.
Nope.
They're both great options. And so, yeah, think about all those things, plus your own goals, what kind of diversification you want to have with your investments. And the results are, of course, going to be different over time. But how much and to what degree is really hard to predict.
No one knows.
We ain't going to try because we don't have any clue. But Kevin, I think this is not a bad conundrum to be in. And really, either way you go, you're not screwing up. Like, you can't screw it up. You can just, you're just making the best choice you can based on your own specific situation.
Exactly. You're optimizing it.
Yes, exactly. All right, Matt, we've got more questions to get to, including one about, like, yeah, some tax changes and how that impacts people who use Cash App, Venmo, stuff like that. We'll get to a listener question on that and more right after this. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host. Or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
All right, we are back. We've got a couple more questions to get to, Joel. And our next one here is from a mother, and she is wondering if I-bonds are still the way to go.
Hi, Matt and Joel. My name is Amanda, and I'm from Knoxville, Tennessee. My son just turned one, and I've really been struggling with what to do with his money. I started a UTMA account for him, but then ended up buying I-bonds, some at the 10% and some at the 6.5% rate, instead of putting it in that account. Do you have any guidance on if I should continue to buy I-bonds or if I should only do that at a certain rate of return threshold? As a side note, I didn't start at 529 because my family historically spends some time in the military where they have access to the GI Bill. I'm concerned if he follows that path, it would be a moot point to have a 529. Any input on my financial planning for him is much appreciated. I was also wondering if you had any recommendations for high yield savings accounts. Thanks, guys.
All right, Amanda, good question. Thanks for submitting it. And I-bonds have, of course, been a great strategy for excess savings for a while now. Matt, we've been singing the I-bond praise tune over here for like, I don't know, over a year now.
A solid 18 months,
18 months,
I guess.
Yeah. And even as the rates dip below 7% on November 1st, I-bonds are still a great choice for lots of folks who want to earn better returns on that money that's allocated for more medium-term use. That's what I-bonds are for. It's medium-term savings. And it's likely that your one-year-old isn't going to need this money anytime soon. I don't think he's going to be buying a house or a car at some sort of major expense. But so in that case, we'd say that you could be investing it on his behalf. But investing for minors without earned income comes with other potential downsides. So it sure seems like I-bonds are a really good choice for with some of this money for the time being.
That's right. But for how long? That's what Amanda wants to know. And she wants to know if she should be socking more money away into I-bonds on her son's behalf. And so it's hard to say, right? Because before inflation really ticked up, I-bonds were incredibly lame for years.
There's like, a reason you didn't hear about them and that no money was flowing into I-bonds.
There's no reason to talk about them.
For like a decade plus.
Yeah, but obviously a nasty bout of inflation is what made them relevant again for the first time in our lifetime. And, you know, if inflation cools significantly, if the fixed rate portion of I-bonds remains low, then there's a good shot that before too long, you know, they won't be a good buy anymore. But because I-bonds are made up of that fixed rate combined with the rate of inflation, the answer to how long I-bonds will remain a good deal, it's impossible to predict. It's sort of like, should I go with the S&P 500 index or should I go with the target date fund? Will international stocks and bonds outperform domestic? It's tough to tell.
Yeah. Well, and I feel like that's we always want to be honest with listeners about that stuff because there are a lot of people out there who do try to make predictions and they don't. That they're looking through like an imperfect crystal ball, a massively imperfect crystal ball. And we just always want to be honest and say like, we can't predict these things. And the people that say they can or are trying to don't necessarily have more information at their disposal either. They just maybe have an abnormal amount of confidence. And so yeah, we would say that trying to make some of these predictions is a fool's errand. And that is something that you should stay away from anyone who says they know what the future holds when it comes to returns of something like the stock market. Mm-hmm. I'd also, Matt, I'd like to know how much money Amanda's infant son has in his name because...
Why are you asking, Joel?
Well, you know, I'm curious because we are trying to answer this question and it would help to know exactly how much money she's working with for him because...
No, not because you're going to steal it or
I'm not planning on like grinching his money or anything like that, but it sounds like her little guy has more cash on hand than, let's say, mine does, right? My three-year-old, he's not rolling in the dough. But it's also important to note that you can't buy more than $10,000 worth of I-bonds in a given year per person. So
if, that limit. Yep.
If he does have 30K or something that you're trying to work with, well, it's going to take a minute to soak all that money up. And now that we're solidly into 2023, you are allowed to drop another 10K if he's crushing it that hard, right? If he's got that much money hanging around, you can put a whole $10,000 into I-bonds. And if there's even more money than that and you don't need I-bonds for yourself, well, you could buy them in your name, but earmark that money for him too. allowing up to $20,000 to be stuck into I-bonds to work for them. And reading between the lines here, this might be something on your mind, Amanda, but the fact that there is some commingling of funds. But since you're talking about your son's money, your family after all, right? And so we see no reason that you can't mix that money as long as you stay disciplined and keep up with it. Mm-hmm. Money's fungible after all. And so as long as you're just trying to choose the best vehicles for him, even if it's not necessarily in his name, but you're trying to save it on for his behalf, that's perfectly fine in our book.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's just a good way of streamlining things as well. If it feels like that, if it's becoming too onerous, right? If it's becoming too much of a lift because you're opening all these different accounts in his name, I think I would be very comfortable personally. Again, it comes down to kind of how disciplined you can be and how well you can keep up with that money and the interest earned. But we also love that you aren't saving for his future college, given your specific circumstances, as you know, you're expecting him to be able to take advantage of the GI Bill to pay for his higher education. But given some recent like major changes to 529 accounts that were just signed into the law just a couple of weeks ago at the end of 2022, saving for kids' college just got way more interesting. And so the quick explanation here is that you can roll unspent 529 funds into a Roth IRA for your kid. Mm-hmm. In reality, there's a little more to it than that. There's some more nuance. And so we'll give a longer explanation and break down all the savings and retirement changes actually on this Wednesday's episode in 2 days.
So definitely tune in for that, because there's like a lot of nuance and specifics you have to follow to use it appropriately. But even for folks who don't want to save for college for their kids anymore, a 529 plan actually makes sense for people now, when otherwise we would have told them to steer clear.
Exactly. Yeah. And in regards to savings accounts, Amanda, if this is for him, just, you know, to be opened in his name, that's a toughie. The best ones for kids, for minors, they typically come from local credit unions. And even then, it's a decent rate, but you're oftentimes limited to a certain amount of money that can earn that higher rate.
Right. A few $1,000 qualify for the higher interest rate that credit unions typically offer.
Exactly. And it's kind of sounding like she's got maybe more money set aside than that for him. But if this is an account for you, again, if you're going to slide some of that money into your name and track it that way, well, we mentioned a few online banks pretty consistently: Ally, Marcus, CIT. Actually, I think they just upped their rate to like north of 4% now. Wow. Which is insane. Discover as well, but they all offer some of the highest rates. They consistently pay the highest rates of interest, as well as offering some solid customer service. Yeah. And so we'd recommend you check them out as well.
Throw Capital One 360 in there as well.
We
mentioned them earlier. Like, there are a lot of good online banks. And so if you're looking for one for yourself, I would look at all the above and see which one best fits the parameters for what you're looking for. But you can't go wrong with any of them, I'd say.
Yep, those are all great.
Yeah. So, Matt, let's get to our last question of this episode. And this one is about some changes to tax law and how it's going to impact likely more than just this listener who's asking this question.
Hey, this is Lucas from Minnesota. I'm about a month behind on my podcast, but I'm hoping at some point I can have some help answering this question. eBay recently updated, well, a lot of places, I believe, updated the amount of money that is made on these apps before they report it to the IRS from $20,000 to $600, I believe. My question is specifically related to hobbies. I buy and sell sports cards, not with the intent of making a profit, but simply as a hobby. I'll often buy $100 to $200 boxes of cards. I'll keep a few and I'll sell the rest just to recoup some of my investment. Rarely am I making a profit, but in eBay's eyes, I am. So I'm wondering how this will impact my taxes. Are taxes calculated on a per sale basis or overall gain and loss, if that makes sense? Do I need to track every single individual sale, or how would be the best way to go about this where I'm not paying taxes on money that's not really net profit? Thanks.
All right. The year is kicking off. It's a busy time of year, Lucas. There are lots of great podcasts to listen to these days, but we appreciate you listening to How to Money and for your question for us.
Favorite podcast, Matt?
Well, How to Money is always there at the top. It's at the top of my list.
I will say Freakonomics just had a great series on Adam Smith, economist, Scottish economist from the 1700s.
We got to nerd out on some of the historical figures that have had a massive impact on how it is that we view money in the world.
Yeah,
most definitely.
That three-part series is worth listening to for sure.
Yes. But Lucas, that new 1099K requirement, it was set to roll out this year, but right at the last minute, not unlike the changes that were signed into law regarding retirement and savings accounts. Similarly, the IRS said at the last minute that they were going to delay that by a year. And so while there's no requirement for those new 1099K forms to go out, there's still a chance that you might end up with one of those in your mailbox. And so here, I mean, the way it works is that places like eBay, Venmo, Airbnb, Etsy, even the Cash App, they've always sent out 1099K forms to folks if they generated over $20,000, but that is going to transition to just $600 by the start of next year, by the start of 2024.
Exactly. It was supposed to be 2023, but no longer.
Exactly.
Fortunately, so, for a lot, so many people, relief.
Yeah. Well, there's going to be a lot of confusion because maybe it wasn't talked about enough, but they're making 2023 a transition year as businesses are able to ramp up their ability to get those 1099K forms out. But to be honest, you know, there's always been an onus on the individual in order to claim and to report any income that's north of $600. And so basically, if you're selling things on eBay and you are generating like meaningful revenue, this is something that you might have been able to, you know, squeak by with in the past, but it's unlikely that you're going to be able to do that moving forward.
Yeah, Matt. So like, you know, I said a minute ago that this is going to be a relief for a lot of folks who, this is going to kind of blindside a lot of people. Like, what is this 1099K and why did I get it? Just have maybe having sold just a few things online or having transferred some payments back and forth on one of these payment platforms, you get one of these things and you owe tax on that 1099K amount that's reported, and you, a lot of people were just going to be shocked by it. And so that was the reason that this delay was implemented. And it might just be buying time to change the reporting thresholds for 1099s. We'll see if, you know, they come to a different agreement this year, and sure, we'll obviously report if that happens. But, you know, given the way that Lucas discussed his situation, even in 2024, he's likely not to have a massively increased tax bill,
right,
based on receiving a 1099K. And we would just say you might want to get in the habit, though, of doing some more record keeping, Lucas. That's for a couple of reasons. First off, you might be making more than you realize, and if you have a talent for spotting sports cards that are like diamonds in the rough, you might be able to scale this hobby up, and you might actually be able to turn it into some significant side income. But secondly,
Lucas's sports cards.
Yeah, and maybe he like
LLC
quits his full-time job because he's able to flip cards so well or something like that. But secondly, like, only if it's an actual business can you deduct any expenses that you incur. And you might have more expenses than you realize too with this business. Who knows? And not only could you deduct expenses, but you can even take a loss, right, if you happen to have a bad year. So these changes started in 2018 with the passing of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Before then, you actually did have the ability to deduct hobby expenses. But yeah, like, this is one of those things where you're going to want to keep track of everything for IRS reporting, but also for kind of knowing how well this side hustle business is actually doing for you.
Totally. And hopefully we hear back from Lucas in a year and he's like, by the way, this is my full-time gig now. Yeah. I'm totally crushing it. But Lucas, like, if you have zero intention of making this an actual business, right? Like, if truly you are just doing this for fun, you don't want to spend any more time on it, maybe you don't have the time to dedicate to it, then don't worry about the record keeping, right? Like, just get your 1099K when it comes next year, report that amount on your taxes as income like you normally would, and you'll just have to pay a little more tax on that income. That being said, actually, sometimes the IRS, they don't give people the option, right, to call it hobby income versus business income. Sometimes they decide it for you if your hobby should be considered a business. And again, this doesn't sound like the case for you, but for others out there, the IRS, they actually have some questions to help folks to determine whether they have a hobby or whether they have a business. And we can link to those questions in our show notes for this episode up on the website. But so much of it is, this is their attempt to clarify, because so much of it's murky, right? Like, so much of it comes down to intent, mm-hmm, is what they say. And so they're kind of, they're providing these questions for you to look at and read yes or no to. And that is supposedly going to help you. Your mileage may vary. And one last thing, by the way, as well, personal payments that you might make to friends or family members on these apps shouldn't be reported on a 1099K. And so what that means is that if you, you know, split a lot of dinners, or, you know, if you pay a friend back for booking a plane ticket for you, and it does trigger a 1099K, well, then we would recommend that you reach out to that payment processor in order to get that corrected. That should not be income that is reported on a 1099K. You do not want to have to pay taxes on that money when in reality they were just paying you back for something.
And again, that's why they delayed this, and that's why they might come up with a better permanent fix, because it's just a weird thing with new payment apps and the how much we use them and how often we're sending money back and forth, but we're not actually buying and selling goods, mm-hmm. it creates like more of a paper trail that can impact people's taxes negatively when it shouldn't. And so, yeah, we'll see what the final outcome of this is. But at least for sales you made last year, they're kind of going back to those old reporting guidelines. You shouldn't receive a 1099-K for those smaller amounts, only if you're doing like legitimate number of sales online and generating real income.
That's right. By the way, so I, we were just talking about paying a friend back for travel. We just booked a spot for us to vacation to this summer.
True.
Did you pay the full amount or did you pay like the half deposit?
Half deposit.
All right. How about, can we put my card on the
sure.
next one?
Yeah.
I got to get that cash back. I got to hit that spend threshold for that Southwest card so that Kate can fly for free.
There you go. All right. No, it's all you, buddy. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, this way we don't have to worry about any of those transactions on Cash App or
yeah,
Venmo.
We just,
even though we do that just constantly.
Yeah, like, we do that anyway.
Nonstop.
People know how it is. When you're doing little stuff with friends online, whether you're booking travel together, whatever, you're always sending money back and forth. Yeah. And this is causing a real problem, a little real wrench in people's taxes. So I'm glad to see the delay. And hopefully that helps Lucas out as well with yep. like his small business or hobby or however he's going to classify it. But it impacts a whole lot of other people too. So, all right, Matt, let's get back to the beer that we had on this episode. This is called Wit. It's by St. Bernardus. What were your thoughts on this beer, my friend?
I will say that this thing drank like a spring or summertime beer, man. Like from the first sip, it reminded me of roses and violets.
Oh.
It had like this very flowery, not in a overly floral kind of way, but you know, like the smell that roses have. It's
yeah.
just, it's like this subtle smell of roses. I don't know how else to describe it, but I feel like this had that floral aspect going on that coupled with like that nice weedy finish.
Yeah.
But
I thought it was clean.
Yeasts.
Yeah.
Right, those Belgian yeasts kind of have that floral element. But for whatever reason, I was just picturing like red and purple flowers.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, all right. I don't necessarily know if I got the same thing, but I will say it was refreshing and clean and
yeah.
just a delicious beer to drink. And I was kind of expecting actually some more Belgian spices because typically like a Belgian wheat is going to have like coriander, allspice or something. It's like some other funky flavors in there.
Expecting it to be more like a Tripel.
Yeah, like I love
coriander.
How reserved this one was and how mm-hmm. it was all about kind of the base beer notes coming through.
Highly crushable.
Yeah, it was well done and it was definitely a good like spring beer. Almost could be like a beach beer too. Like no one's going to the beach in January or at least anywhere around here that I know of. But yeah, when we do go to the beach, this might be one I'll take.
Although anytime you go to the beach, like I swear anytime you take any beer to the beach that has any type of flavor, it just feels like too much.
Yeah.
Right? Like typically on the beach, you just want something that virtually is flavorless.
Or
if you're drinking
sour beers, always work.
Oh yeah, yeah, sour beers always. They're yeah, fantastic as
for
well.
For sure,
gets me excited about things warming up. I mean, I don't know. We shouldn't be looking that far forward. Perhaps let's enjoy the weather and the season that we have now. But it is fun to think about what the summer might hold for us, whether it comes to where we are or what we're drinking. But that's going to be it for this episode. Like we mentioned, definitely look for that episode to drop on Wednesday. We're going to cover a lot of the recent news regarding the changes to different investments and savings accounts and how you can benefit from some of those changes.
We're actually going to be writing about it in our newsletter too, Matt, our How to Money newsletter that comes out every single Tuesday. So make sure you go to howtomoney.com/newsletter to sign up for that. It's free, full of friendly advice in your inbox every single week.
There's lots of different ways that you can ingest this financial news that
right.
we are doling out for you. But dude, that's going to be it for this specific episode. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
It's brand new season 2. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. Join late night legend Jon Stewart and the best news team for today's biggest headlines, exclusive extended interviews, and more. Now this is a second term we can all get behind. Listen to The Daily Show Ears Edition on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Something that makes me crazy is when people say, well, I had this career before, but it was a waste. And that's where the perspective shift comes, that it's not a waste, that everything you've done has built you to where you are now. This is She Pivots, the podcast where we explore the inspiring pivots women have made and dig deeper into the personal reasons behind them. Join me, Emily Tisch Sussman, every Wednesday on She Pivots. Listen to She Pivots on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.